it's time once again for Truth About Markets, 104.4 Resonance. Max and Stacy for the next 60 minutes. Yeah, this is the show that's been keeping it real for a number of years. Number of years.
Well, yes, it's been a busy week. It's been a busy week, honey. Do you want to tell the people what happens this upcoming week?
Yes, I do. There will be more activity in the precious metal markets all over the world as people scramble to buy gold. You see, there, as we've been saying on this show, we ask the question, at what price will there be panic buying in gold? Panic buying in gold. People talk about gold as achieving its price targets, as possibly being in a bubble, and yet it hasn't even really appreciated back to its old adjusted inflation high of $2,200 an ounce, give or take. You see? So once it gets through 2,000, that's my thought, then you're going to start to see some panic buying for gold. And of course, listeners to Resonance 104.4, they know that we've been talking about this, and they've been safe in their gold caves as the pound and the dollar have dropped.
Yes, well, of course, gold is a good hedge against currency collapses. But I was reading in the Financial Times about this, the boom in gold market, that a huge quantity of the gold is being physical gold. People are buying physical gold. And where it's coming from is places like Switzerland and Italy. And apparently, the number one, the biggest demand is for 100 gram gold bars, not coins. The 100 gram gold bars, which are about 3.5 ounces. And it seems that a lot of this is because of Switzerland turning over information about accounts to the U.S., but they're also now going to turn over information to France and Germany. So you have a lot of people with sometimes millions and millions of dollars that they don't want to give over. It's going to be taken from them. So what they're doing is they're buying gold. And because they figure they can hide that in their backyard and there's no sort of data on it. And the Financial Times also points out that, the gold manufacturers, the people who manufacture the bars, were saying, we just deliver it to the bank.
Right.
We don't know who it's going to.
Yeah, well, that's right. There's one big buyer, a motivated buyer, as we say, a motivated buyer. The country of India was motivated to buy 200 tons 2 weeks ago. China bought 300 tons last year, or earlier this year. They're going to be buying another 200 or 300 tons in the next few weeks. That's what I hear.
Well, what about Barrick Gold's announcement this past week?
Yeah, tell the people.
Barrick Gold is the world's largest gold producer. And they were pretty infamous in the gold, the gold bug arena. Everybody knew them as the gold mining company that participated in a gold suppression scheme with the U.S. government.
Mm.
So they were delivering them, they were hedging all their gold. They were selling their gold at like $300 when it was selling for $900 in the open market because of their hedges. Well, they've just got rid of all their hedges. And then this past week, the CEO of the company at some conference said that we've hit peak gold, and people just don't understand that it's harder and harder to find any gold.
Yeah, that's right. Gold, I think this one people can wrap their mind around easier than they can wrap their mind around peak oil. Hopefully people can understand this concept of peak gold, because it's, I think it's a little bit more easy for the brain to contemplate that if you dig into the earth for gold and eventually you can't dig anymore, you've got all the gold you can dig for. And these mining companies, including Barrick, which is the world's largest gold mining company now in the world, have said that the world has hit peak gold. Now, I don't think this is a conspiracy theory, as some might suggest, of course. Some ascribe a conspiracy theory to any piece of news that comes down the pike. You know, there are conspiracies, there are conspiracy theories, and there are bits of actual information. What I can tell you, Stacy, is that peak gold is a reality, peak water is a reality, and peak oil is a reality. The Earth's ability to sustain this level of industrialization that's been going on the last 25, 50 years is finished.
Yeah, well, the CEO of Barrick also pointed out something that is remarkably similar to the oil situation, is that he said that the gold that they are finding is of lower quality and much more difficult locations to get. You know, a lot of oil finds that are heralded in the news with giant headlines are things like the Brazilian oil find, which is like 6 miles down below ocean and inside the Earth's crust, deep below layers of salt and very high temperatures, for example. And the same with gold is like it's being found in more not only politically hostile regions, but environmentally hostile.
Yeah, well, in the case of peak oil, the energy it takes to get the oil now is equal or more than the energy you get from burning the oil that you find. The cost. The cost of the energy to find the oil is greater than the profits you make burning the oil on the other side. So that's what peak oil is all about. It's not that the world runs out of oil. No, the world has run out of oil that you can drill cost effectively. That's what it means, peak oil. That's what peak oil means. The cost effective drilling of oil is finished. The 95 million barrels a day or so that was the peak this past year will most likely be the peak going forward for the rest of time. Just like the amount of oil that comes out of the three biggest oil fields in the world have peaked. Just like in the 1970s, the oil coming out of America peaked. So global peak oil, I don't know why this is such a hard concept for people to understand.
But you know, the fact is we have an almost unlimited supply, for example, of iron. Unfortunately, it's like 1,000 miles down into the core of the earth. But, you know, so you could argue that we have all of the iron for ore that we could possibly need.
Yeah, or they just found water on the moon, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you can say, oh, peak water is false because there's water on the moon. Well, yeah, except, you know, it's not cheap to go get it, is it? You know, now, two years ago, starting in the year 2007, on August of 2007, when BNP announced that the hedge funds that were operating by Bear Stearns were engaged in some fraudulent accounting, you know, we hit peak credit. Which is another story, peak credit that now, some call deflation, has been enforced for 2 years now. And now that the artificial stimulus that has come from the additional artificial credit that's been used to try to stem the economy, this is really low-grade credit that the Barack Obama administration is the cubic zirconia of credit that they've been used to falsify the so-called GDP growth of the past 6 months. Now they can't even afford to flood the markets with any more of this junk credit, as there are now, by some accounts, $20 trillion more in bad commercial real estate loans and assorted other debts that have to be marked to market. And you're going to see this currency crisis that we've been involved with as a result of peak credit take another trip down to the netherworld of currency hell. That's another buyer of gold. That's another motivated buyer of gold. Anybody who owns paper currencies, they are a motivated buyer of gold because paper currencies are becoming increasingly more worthless. So let's see, who else is buying gold? Another reason. So you got peak gold, you've got cyclical gold, you've got, of course, the gold to Dow ratio historically will come into force. You know, gold and the Dow Jones have traded one for one twice in their history so far, once in the 30s, once in the 1980s. And we're going to see that once again, probably around the 5,000 level, where the Dow Jones gets down to 5,000 and the price of gold gets to $5,000 an ounce. And so that's still happening.
And of course, people, you're talking about peak credit. and how they're having to mine more and more credit in order to find any value in it. So you have the Bank of England or the US Federal Reserve Bank engaged in quantitative easing, and they're printing more and more money and pushing more and more money to these, what are euphemistically maybe they're called banks, right? But I think the problem obviously is they're all Ponzi scheme operators for the most part, and they know that every other, it takes a con to recognize a con, doesn't it? So they all recognize each other as con men, and therefore they're afraid to push any, well, they're reluctant to give credit to any other
Well, it's
fellow
called
con
the
men.
game theory. In
That's
other
right.
words, when con men recognize other players in the game as con men, that's called game theory. It's John Nash's contribution to mathematics, if you will. And that the prisoner's dilemma is in full force. Nobody wants to be the first to start making loans because they don't believe that the quality of the ability for anyone to pay back these loans is sufficient. So they're just sitting on their hordes of government supplied low grade credit. And they're, just unwilling to make anything go forward. So you have this peak credit scenario is
And
building.
into the scenario of peak credit is a story here about from the Financial Times. The title is Household, HOLED, and it's talking about HSBC's earnings.
Oh, yeah.
This is interesting. Buried in HSBC's third quarter update was an announcement that the bank had sold its U.S. vehicle loan servicing business, along with $1 billion of loans to Santander for $904 million. In spite of warm words of encouraging trends in consumer loan losses and tentative plans to hand out more credit cards, this is the reality. The bank cannot get out of North America fast enough. Dispatching the chief executive to Hong Kong was part of a narrative that began this year when the bank expressed regret for the 2003 purchase of Household. Remember, we here live on Resonance 104.4 FM discussed this, their HSBC's purchase of Household, and said it would blow up in their face.
Yeah, we did. We gave them, as we do many times in the show, in real time, we said, this is the purchase. It's going to be marked down to zero. The bank is insane for doing this. Continue.
Well, so then it goes on to compare. So HSBC went into the US market big time,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
So it then compares HSBC's to Standard Chartered, another giant UK domiciled bank. And it says the market is not yet sold on HSBC. HSBC has been left in the dust by Standard Chartered, another UK domiciled bank trading profitably and paying dividends to its shareholders, yet focused almost exclusively on less developed markets. Standard Chartered's year-to-date return is more than four times as good as HSBC. The pace of HSBC's backpedaling now from the US is impressive. It says they still have not gone far enough. They're still trying to get out. So they're totally abandoning the US market.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. HSBC, as we've been saying, they jumped into the subprime market by buying Household International Finance, which is a predatory lender. I think also they're involved in the paycheck loans, if I'm not mistaken. This is the where people in the ghetto, they need a dollar right now to buy a bottle of Ripple. So they are able to get a
Riffle.
Ripple or a Mad Dog 2020 or a nickel bag of smack or maybe a tray bag of dope. And they might work as custodians down there at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street, and they pay them maybe $50 a week. But they can't, make it to Friday when the eagle flies, as the song says, to get their money to buy their smack. So they go to Household and get a loan against their paycheck, and Household charges them like 80, 90, 120% annualized interest on that loan. And needless to say, it's a profitable business, like most ghetto businesses that Wall Street and the City of London underwrite and finance. And however, in this particular period in history, the ghetto lending business blew up as a result of peak credit that blew up starting in the summer of 2007 when Chuck Prince made the famous remark that as long as the music's playing, we'll keep dancing. 6 weeks later, he was out of a job. And it was the beginning of the falling dominoes that we now call the credit crisis, currency crisis of the double zeros. So they were in this business. Now they're trying to get out of the business. But of course, a few others made the similar mistakes. A few other of these paycheck and subprime lenders were bought out by large banks. I'm trying to think of the European banks that made similar mistake. I think there was one other European bank that made a similar acquisition of a similar business. They also are writing down these assets as fast as they possibly can. Now, HSBC, last I checked, has a market capitalization near $200 billion. It's a highly capitalized bank.
I think it's the biggest bank in the world. Now, it used to be Citigroup. But,
China is bank.
Oh, yeah, China's bank might be bigger
now. They're big, yeah.
Okay.
They can sustain the write-off.
They were able to. But they were the very first bank, remember, to announce a giant write-off. I believe it was $11 billion, their first write-off on U.S. Subprime mortgages. Remember, that was, I think that was in like 2006.
Oh, sure, I do.
Remember that we announced that here. But what I'm saying is, like, you're starting to see more signs of where large participants, big participants in the market think things are going in the future. So you see HSBC, certainly one of the five biggest banks in the world, they're like visibly, energetically, aggressively moving out of the U.S. market. It seems they want zero exposure to any American consumer.
Mm-hmm.
You see India and China and other large U.S. dollar holders trying to get rid of their dollars at all cost. And gold is a good way to get rid of it because, of course, it's priced in dollars for the most part. And plus it rises in value as the dollar falls. The other thing we're seeing is oil. I was reading about these oil futures contracts.
Yeah.
You see that oil right now in the futures market is trading at $100 already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that, yeah. Well, again, it's because of a few things. You've got the dollar weakness, and you've got the decoupling. You know, the decoupling theory, which has been bandied about for a year or so. Can the world grow without the U.S.? And at first it looked like it could, and then it looked like it couldn't when the dollar rallied in 2008. But now it looks like it can again. It looks like they can get growth in China and India and Brazil and these other countries without the U.S. as the reserve currency and primary economic driver in the world economy by doing deals with themselves. You know, China now does more export business with Japan than the U.S. They do more export business with South Korea than they do with the U.S. So all these countries, Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, China, they're all doing bilateral deals and deals amongst themselves. They're creating new currencies to replace the dollar as reserve currency. You've got the South American Sucre. You've got a new currency coming together in the Middle East, which could be backed by gold. You've got Robert Fisk talking about the oil exporting countries getting together and abandoning the dollar and creating a new currency backed by gold in some part. So all these countries are figuring out that they don't need really the U.S. as their primary export market anymore, and another reason to be a motivated seller of U.S. dollars. The only thing the U.S. has to defend the dollar are these suicide bankers. In other words, if another banker goes to Congress and says that if you don't give us a bailout, we're going to blow ourselves up, as Paulson did, or Tim Geithner does, or Ben Bernanke does, this is the only way that they can defend the dollar is by destroying as many of them as they possibly can, by saying, well, we've got $10, $15, $20 trillion worth of bad debts that are priced in dollars, and we're going to mark that down to zero unless you give us a big bailout. And what happens is when they do blow up these banks by the suicide bankers, the number of dollars in circulation decreases and thus gives value to the remaining dollars in circulation. That's what happened in 2008. You had the suicide bankers gave huge great boost to the value of the dollar, and then the bailout money has offset that, and you've got the primary trend in the weakness in the dollar. It's part of my grand inflation and deflation unified theory of economics.
Mm-hmm.
Stacey.
Why don't you remind them again what that is?
Well, it's what I just said. In other words, you've got the ability to show either $20 trillion in bad debts to get Congress to give you more money, or you've got the Fed threatening to print $20 trillion worth of bad credit if they don't get what they want. So either side of the hostage situation where the American and UK taxpayers being held hostage by suicide bankers, they can either show inflation or deflation depending on whether they print $20 trillion or reveal $20 trillion worth of losses, depending on whatever the situation warrants. You know, if you go into a bank robbery and, you know, if you pull out a knife and the guy who you're robbing the bank from pulls out a gun, you got to pull out your gun. So similarly, if you're Tim Geithner and you're stealing trillions of dollars on behalf of the suicide bankers and somebody in Washington like Ron Paul pulls out a knife, you got to pull out your gun. You know, you got to be adaptive to the situation because you're in the middle of a huge bank heist.
Well, the other thing I'm noticing in the U.S. and, of course, the U.K. is really quite tied to the U.S. in terms of policies they adopt. And I noticed that, you know, a few key oligarchs of various industries run everything in the government. And government is supposed to be by and for the people. But you notice that if the people demand change or reform, or they identify a problem with the system, they seem to be punished by the financiers and bankers that run the system. So, you know, obviously the U.S. healthcare system is a broken system. I mean, even the people who don't want any sort of change, they have to say that 50 million people not having insurance or able to afford it is a failed market in that sort of a system. Well, the new legislation that has emerged in the U.S. is basically, it increases the cost, right? So they're giving $500 billion to health insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I mean, that's anytime. So this is what, you know, the insurance industry, which is part of the financial services and banking industry. So they are punishing the people for daring to say they want to change. The same thing with the new regulations, the so-called regulations involving banks, is it's actually even worse. They're punishing the people for daring to say that these lords should be regulated.
Well, you know what it's like. I tell you what it's like. In other words, this is similar to what we talked about in this show a couple of years ago. If Greenpeace goes into Exxon and says, you know, here's a list of 10 things, 10 ways you guys are fouling the environment, Exxon doesn't think about fixing the problem. They call their insurance broker or their banker, and they say, look, we've got risk on these 10 items. We need to create more financial insulation between us and these 10 problems. And to pay for the insurance and to pay for the financial insulation, they actually lower their operating standards. And as a result, the ecological problems that Exxon generates get worse. So had Greenpeace never gone to Exxon, the environment would actually be better. Now, similarly, when the American public goes to Washington and says, here are the 10 ways we're getting screwed by the health system, well, Washington simply allows the health industry and the health insurance industry to create more financial insulation for themselves. And to pay for the financial insulation, they've got to degrade the current health system even more.
So that you the consumers, the citizens, demand what was previously just a bad system. They make it even worse and more vicious and aggressive and violent towards the population.
To pay for the financial insulation that's been identified by the people getting victimized. But you see that happen all the time in third world countries, you know, and people, and obviously, and if you're living, and we're quite used to this in countries where people rise up and say, we don't have freedom of speech and the dictators in charge kill them. Okay, so it hasn't come to that quite yet in the U.S., but it's similar. If the people rise up and say, we're dying, 45,000 of us are dying every year with no health insurance, well, the response of the government is not to just kill people, but they do give the corporations who are doing the killing more economic welfare benefits to insulate themselves from the risks of these people who are complaining, which is effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
Because you have dictators. I mean, the people, it's a corporate dictatorship. And anytime anyone complains, they get punished. And, you know, in these societies that are run by dictators, the people learn not to say anything. To just hide in their homes, keep the window drawn, and do their simple jobs and take their slave wages, and they get trained to do that.
It's also like the neo-feudalism, as you've called it. It's like, remember during the feudal times, you read of the peasants' revolt. So the peasants rose up, when was this, down in the 1500s or something in the UK? And they rose up, and the king met with them. The king pretended to be friends with them and actually be kind and be a benevolent king and listen to them. So, you know, the leaders of the peasant revolt thought they believed the promises of the king that he would take care of the problem. And they sent the thousands of peasants back home. Just go home. And then sure enough, what happened? All the leaders of the peasant revolt were killed. Decapitated.
Mm-hmm.
Afterward. And then, but the revolt had been squashed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just saw an example of that now. It's on the tip of my tongue. Something that just happened last week where the people were basically placated. And the dissent calmed down. And I'll think of it probably before the end of the show. But anyway, the pattern has been a well-established pattern. And this is the problem that you have now with these groups in the U.S. Because they don't bother to include the economics of their action, they are making the situation much worse for them. Like, so you see groups like Code Pink on TV all the time, and they're doing protests, and they're in Congress, and they're holding up placards, and you know, they do a good job making people aware of what's going on, but because they have no economic battle plan, they leave themselves open to economic retribution. You know, you don't think that the fact that they're depriving people of health care isn't a direct retribution against everybody who protested the war in Iraq, who protested the thrown elections of 2000 and 2004, who protested illegal occupations, who protested America's corrupt foreign policy? You don't think it's just a way to punish those people? They said, look, we don't want you speaking out on these issues that we're making monopoly profits on. Therefore, we're going to cut you off from your health care. How do you like that? You know, yeah, the hell with you. We're going to cut you off from your health care. Now see how do you like that, sucker? And the people who are trying to fight for health care, they don't see the whole thing holistically. They don't have any economic battle plan. And they're just walking directly into the line of fire with no thought about it, hoping. And they say, well, I'm going to die with a clear conscience. Which is your prerogative, you can do that, but don't think you're doing anything constructive. Now, on this show, we've talked about a couple of constructive ways people can fight back nonviolently, one being Karma Bank and the other one being the Gold Purchase Program, and I'm not going to go into it again now, but unfortunately, there's not been wide-scale adoption of these programs because I don't think that people understand that the war that was fought 200 years ago in the U.S. anyway for independence, what relevance that has today. And
I think I think activists or anybody who wants a change from the neo-feudalism or oligarchy, whatever you want to call it, that we have now, I think they fail to understand that it's a war. And as such, I think they should read something like The Art of War. They go there, like you say, you know, they go there and say, this is what's wrong. Like, they go to the table with no plan on taking out their enemy, taking out the, at blocking their enemy. You know, at the person on the other side wants them dead. They want them in debt first.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to basically destroy their freedom, mm-hmm. because freedom is like, would entail independence from them. So from this corporation and their expensive services. So you have to, they go there with no battle plan.
That's right. They go there with no battle plan. And as a result, they're losing. You don't have a plan. If you fail to plan to fail.
It's like them going to the table, you know, had say France and Germany are in a war, and France would go to Germany and sit down, you know, the generals would sit down and say to the German general, oh, please don't go shoot us in, you know, Lyon. We're really vulnerable there, and you're killing all our guys there. And if you kill all our guys, we'll never be able to counterattack. Well, what would the Germans do?
Yeah, well, the thing is that the folks who are getting victimized and abused by the system think that the problem is an unbalanced morality quotient in society, that the bad guys need to learn the moral equivalent of the social contract that is a prerequisite for living in a civilized society, and that by educating them about this, that balance will be restored. And they keep going down the same path over and over again, that they've got moral superiority, and that moral superiority is going to eventually win. And they think of them all, it's like Joan of Arc complex, that they just feel that they were touched by God. See, the problem is that liberals are egomaniacs more even than conservatives. And that's the really ultimately what the bottom line is. Conservatives are full of themselves, and they don't mind stealing somebody else's wealth, and they are certainly, you know, have big egos. But liberals, you know, you find these egomaniacs, these Joan of Arc types, who believe that they're hearing words directly from God, and that their actions are the actions of God. And they're getting mowed down by the millions now. And their campaign completely doesn't work because they consider themselves too high and mighty to debase themselves by getting into the trenches and fighting this economic guerrilla warfare by trying to decapitalize your enemy. The way to get rid of the bad guys is to take away their money. And you have to decapitalize them or they will decapitate you. That's your dilemma. Decapitation by your enemy or decapitalize your foe. That's your choice. And more, you know, people typically, you know, choose not to get into the mud and fight this economic guerrilla warfare in hand-to-hand combat, and they're being destroyed. And gold's going higher, so I'm basically, personally, I've got both sides of this fight. You know, I'm not a liberal or a conservative. I consider myself to be a political moderate, and I'm willing to continue to, you know, hold my gold for another 10 years.
So, have you read about this this new bill introduced by Christopher Dodd, where he's pushing to create a single industry regulator and would strip powers from the Federal Reserve Bank?
Well, you know, 2 weeks ago on the show, there was a rumor that Tony Blair was going to step down from being nominated as EU president. Now I see his name's being tossed back into the ring. In other words, Tony Blair is going to be the EU president. That's been baked into the cake for 5 years. Everything else is a kabuki dance of nonsensical posturing that means nothing. He is slated to be that role. He's going to get that job. Similarly, there will be nobody who is ever going to crack the nut of the Federal Reserve's opaque criminal accounting system. And they can talk about it, and they can say that they're interested in doing so, but it'll never happen. It's a Sisyphean task where the closer anyone gets to actually auditing the Fed, the bigger the bribe and the graft under the table gets. So all it is a fake threat, because whoever it is talking like this, they want a huge campaign contribution from one of these guys, and that's it. They have no integrity to audit the Fed whatsoever, and nobody in America or the UK has any integrity in their protestations against the corrupt banking system because they refuse to pull away from participating in that system in any meaningful way. So everything else is basically a cartoon and everybody enjoys entertainment value, but nobody is serious.
Well, of course, yes, because Christopher Dodd is the Democratic senator from Connecticut, and he's the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. So, you know, he is facing a very tough challenge in Connecticut for re-election next year. And not only is Peter Schiff running against him, but the Republican candidate is apparently polling better than Christopher Dodd. So I guess maybe Christopher Dodd is looking for exactly these sort of headlines, you know, so he can, in his campaign ads, he can run, "Banks bill seeks to strip Fed of power," so he can pretend that he did something. He just needs the headlines, right?
Yeah, exactly. He wants to take the spotlight away from Peter Schiff. You know, Peter Schiff obviously is interested in auditing the Fed. He's interested in sound money policies. He's interested in accounting, accountability. And he's got some support out there. And I'm sure he would really do well as a senator and be able to bring to the halls of Congress some sound money thinking. And so if there's any possibility that he'll gain any traction in this election, then these flakes like Dodd are going to wear Peter Schiff's clothes for a couple of months just to make it look like he also believes in sound money until he gets reelected. And then he'll, of course, throw that in the garbage and go right back to the graft and bribes and skullduggery that our congresspeople are known for.
What is it with Connecticut? That's my home state. But, you know, it has all of these sleazebag senators, Lieberman and
Dodd.
More
so than others? Other states?
Yeah, there's something particularly sleazy about them. But maybe Connecticut people are stupid, too, because it just doesn't make any sense that they reelect these people year after year after year after year, and yet they're every single time they campaign.
Well, you have no choice.
They
you
lie.
Know, who are you going to choose? Who are you going to vote for? What are the choices, you know? If anyone ever really comes down the pike who's a credible political candidate, they're killed.
Well, yeah, they're killed via propaganda. It's amazing, too, that people just believe propaganda. And all it needs is, like, one bad morning. Like, you look ugly or you shout or you do something stupid on camera. And then it gets played over and over and over.
Well, how's that suppository salesman Dave Cameron doing in the UK?
Well, that's another amazing thing is, like, it's just kind of blah, you know, he seems like New Labour to me. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It just all seems puffy. Everything, there's kind of this weird puffy vagueness to everything anyway. In the last
puffy vagueness sounds like a rap star.
Puffy vagueness. Yeah. Well, that's kind of what it seems like. All politicians basically have to. They're all puffy and vague because you need to make sure that you don't actually, upset the media or don't tell anybody what you're actually going to do.
Yeah, okay. So nothing's going on with him. He's just kind of floating on the best wishes of 10,000 blue-haired people out there in the hunting quadrants of the UK. Get the chase, the hunt.
Well, I'm sure.
Did the hunters win their right to go hunt foxes? The fox hunters?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's ever enforced.
No, it's not enforced. Apparently
they're now having a big problem in the UK as well with a fox running all over the place. You know, they're exploding in population.
No, right. So yeah, right. Sure, they need the hunters to come and help them. It's a solution. It's not a problem. I'm sure the Daily Mail will run a huge story about this. If Britain's being threatened by the overpopulation of foxes. Quick, let's mount up.
So what's going on in Japan? Because, you know, Obama's there in Japan.
No, is he in Japan? I didn't know that. They have a town in Japan named Obama.
They do. They do.
Remember during the election, they were all excited.
Yeah.
Obama, Japan.
That's right.
That sounds like a Steely Dan song.
Yeah, but so this new, the president, the new prime minister, I guess, of their country.
Oh, yeah.
He became the Japan's Democratic Party won by basically being anti-American.
Cool.
Honey.
What? So, what's the big deal?
Well, They won election, you know. Basically, there had been a monopoly on power by that conservative party for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one-party rule, as they have there.
Yes.
But now they're, they're trying to kick the U.S. Marines out after 50
years. Toro.
After 50 years of occupation.
Yeah. Well, that's a good move.
And I think the population, I mean, a little bit too late, but, you know, they already blew through all their savings. But they blew through their savings supporting the dollar or helping out the dollar, you know.
Yeah, their savings rate was, 20%? Now it's 2%?
Yeah.
And they're running through what's left of their savings. So they went through this huge 20-year lost decade that's become two lost decades. Pursuing Keynesian policies of government stimulation by Basically, just getting the keeping the zombie banks and the zombie corporations alive, and to hope that this would stimulate things. It never did. Now they're running out of savings. Now it looks like country is going to be the first of the big countries to head into sovereign debt failure. You know, it's a race between Japan, the UK, and I guess the US are the top three contenders. Who will default on their debt first? I guess US is the least likely, given the fact that it does still have the world reserve currency. That leaves the UK and Japan. And according to Ambrose Evan Pritchard in the Telegraph a couple of weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, he's putting his money on Japan.
That's right. Mish thinks that the yen will crash first
The
because of the
yen.
giant deficits.
Yeah, Mish, Mike Shedlock over there at Mish, Mike Shedlock blog, who is really the most prolific financial writer in the blogosphere and really the first stop on any tour of the financial sites, in my opinion. You got to go to Mish, check out his insights. He was basically king of the hill in 2008 for sure, and he's in the top three for 2009 without a doubt. He's calling for a yen collapse.
So the issue this is these are some interesting numbers because I
It's
didn't
more than
really
a buyer.
understand this the Japanese hatred for these US bases there, the military bases. Now the problem is that most of the bases are on Okinawa. And Okinawa, just to put it into context, represents 0.6% of Japan's total land area.
Okay, well, it's not a big place, is it, Japan?
It's not, but so Okinawa is only less than 1% of all of Japan.
Yeah, it's about 0.6%, isn't it?
0.6%. But Okinawa is home to 75% of the territory occupied by US military bases.
Yeah.
So nearly 10% of Okinawa is under US control, and almost 20% of the island is off limits to ordinary citizens. So, Max, you can look at this map. I know people listening won't be able to see it, but you see those dark areas. This is Okinawa.
Looks like Palestine.
Yeah, exactly. All these dark areas are US military bases.
Oh, yeah.
So apparently the local population considers it's not only it's very noisy because you have lots of planes taking off and landing and live fire ranges,
A lot of
but
Marines
also a lot of Marines, so
burping and farting.
there's lots of off-base crime by US military.
Oh, there's a couple of rapes, right? Wasn't that a big story a couple of years ago?
Yep.
It was shocked the Japanese people, the U.S. servicemen rape case.
So Zenji Shimada and
Wait,
Shimada.
Shimada? What? Genji Shimada? I don't know get Shimadas in Okinawa. Genji Shimada?
Shimada.
Oh, Shimada. It's a woman.
Maybe that's their version of Shimada. They put a
Shimada.
Shimada.
Shimada-san.
Well, it's a he, and he is
Oh,
a
sorry,
anti.
dude.
He's an anti-base.
Didn't see your big swinging thing.
He's an anti-base
Well, not big. What is it?
campaigner. He says
Notoriously small.
Okinawa is not a prefecture. Okinawa is a military colony of the U.S. and
Yeah,
Japanese governments.
that's right. So this fact is now being talked about by the new government in Japan.
Yes,
Who is
because
the new government? What are they? Who is
it's
in there? The conservatives?
a no, it's a Democratic Party now,
Yeah, Democratic Party, yeah.
and the new Prime Minister is Yukio Hatoyama.
Yukio Hatoyama, yeah, what's his deal? Does he have any, hobbies like playing Japanese lute or something?
Well, his wife, remember, she believes she was abducted in by aliens and taken in a spacecraft somewhere.
No, that's right. That was in the papers. That's right.
Yeah.
What was that all about? She's on
She
Britain's Got
hallucinated.
Talent, or what's going on? She's had a hallucination. She's had a bad sushi. Had one of those
Exactly.
puffy blowfish sushi poisonous meals that gives you brain damage. What's going on? Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say something that was inconsistent with my respectful commentary per the wife of the leader of an important country? I'm so sorry. Please accept my apology. I'm sorry. Alien abducted wife person. Shishami Shama? Shishmada? Look, man, those are U.S. Army bases on Okinawa, and I'm a U.S. man. You get it? I'm American. I own that little island. You can't get rid of me. What are you going to do about it? Japanese man? Nothing. Because we got to keep the world safe from terrorists. Terrorists! What are they going to do? How are they going to get rid of this infestation of Marines?
Well, that's a good question.
Good mom, bad sushi?
Of course they could just stop supporting the U.S. debt. You know, the U.S. isn't able... The military occupations around the world would not be possible if it were not for Japan buying so many U.S. treasury bonds.
That's right. All the savings of Japan goes to America that uses the money to finance the military occupation. So all Japan has to do is stop buying U.S. treasury bonds. And America can't afford to keep those frickin' Marines in Okinawa. So in other words, it's all, once again, it's all talk, no action. That the government of Japan can simply pull the plug on the Japanese ownership of these U.S. Treasury bonds, and all the Marines will go sailing home from Okinawa. So either A, they support the economy in Okinawa by buying lots of noodles in a cup and condoms, and they don't want to get rid of these Marines. Or B, somebody in the Japanese government is fibbing.
That's right. Somebody might be fibbing. And apparently there's some of the bases are supposed to move to Guam. And from the headline...
No, not to Guam.
Oh, Guam's... Yeah, exactly.
Guam is already totally marined out.
I think something like 30 or 40%.
They knocked out every indigenous person on Guam. There's how many are left? Two dozen? They got less Guamese than Sioux Indians and on the plains of America. That's another indigenous tribe that's been wiped out by America's gift of safety.
You know, U.S. is the total welfare bum state. Not only do you have like all these banking welfare bums running the country, but
it's another My Lai massacre in Guam.
Well, no, but part of the... way to get rid of the U.S.
What they asked the Vietnamese? They got rid of all their Marines infestation problem.
But the U.S. wants Japan to pay for their move to Guam.
What?
Exactly.
Yo, Japanese people, why are you smoking your belly button lint? What is going on over there? Ask the Vietnamese how they got rid of their infestation of Marines. Okay, they're the only ones that really trounced American in a war in the last 50, 60 years. You know, they should be given lessons. Why don't they hire Vietnamese consultants to come over and say, look, we got this marine infestation problem. How do we get rid of them? Okay, Guam, same thing. You know, why can't the Vietnamese, you know, offer themselves out as consultants? The Vietnamese consultant agency, I think it's a buy. I'd be buying it. Listed on the... Hey, you see, Hong Kong is now being cracked down upon as a offshore haven. By these American and British banks that want all that money laundering business for themselves. They don't want Switzerland to have it anymore.
Exactly. Well, I think it's just, U.S. citizens are going to be the pariah. It's a way to lock U.S. citizens into their own country.
How's that?
Well, they're not able to go anywhere. They're not able to leave the country. Because the U.S. demands... total capitulation by every single other government that allows a U.S. citizen to live within their territory, to operate within their territory.
Yeah, what are those four states that are right in the middle of the U.S.? Like four states are
Nebraska,
contiguous.
Kansas.
Nebraska, Kansas.
Idaho.
Some other flyover state.
Iowa.
Yeah. What you do is you should force McDonald's, Starbucks, and Krispy Kreme. They can only open branches in those four states. That way all Americans are constantly looking inward. See? They're constantly gravitating toward the center of the country.
That's interesting.
You see? They would have their backs to the borders. And they wouldn't think about escaping because all the Krispy Kremes and McDonald's and Starbucks are in Kansas. So they're all chasing their way to Kansas. Why don't they just put the headquarters in Kansas? It'd be like, you know, every year they have the Hajj going to Mecca. You got like a million Islamic people, Muslim people going to Mecca. If you have like the headquarters of Krispy Kreme, McDonald's, and Starbucks all in Kansas and have a yearly Hajj, the people... You give them a 50% discount on donuts. And, 30 million Americans would be on their way to Kansas every year, and they wouldn't be running for the borders to get out of there. You know what I'm saying?
I think it's a good idea. I'm considering it.
That's right.
Did you know, I read, I didn't read. I was told by somebody involved in something that would give them knowledge of this, is that Kansas is like a major drug trafficking hub inside the U.S.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
That's right.
Kansas City or
That's
something.
What they call Smack Dorothy there.
Smack Dorothy?
They call all the smacks called Dorothy. They say, give me a little Dorothy, man. I want to smack up.
Have you ever been to Kansas?
Never in my life.
Hmm.
No, never been there. Wichita? The Wichita lineman.
Yeah, what
does it matter? Glenn, what's that guy's name? Glenn somebody. Glenn.
Beck?
Not that schmata. Glenn, the singer with the guitar. Glenn. Wichita Llama on the line, man. Wichita man. Wichita. He used to be on the Johnny Carson show a lot. Glenn somebody.
I don't think anybody
Glenn
knows.
Campbell. Glenn Campbell.
Uh-huh.
He was America, you know, in America in the 1970s. You know that the wages in the 1970s in America were the highest in 100 years, vis-a-vis purchasing power and inflation rates?
Yep.
That was really the, you know, America, if you think about it, all that disco dancing and car washing and Glenn Campbell and Johnny Carson and the Bee Gees, and you also had in the 1970s disco, and that was the high point of American purchasing power, wages, and inflation. So if you were working in Detroit making some money, you know, you could actually, you had a very high standard of living relative to other countries, other developed countries around the world. That was the high point. It was under Reagan. When Reagan came into office and began deregulating the financial markets, meant that your purchasing power of your wages started to vitiate.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were actually speaking of this in the last few days, that in France, you know, when workers strike, it's presented to the rest of the world as some sort of, you know, people just being restless. But their demands are always, you often see on signs that pouvoir d'achat, they want to maintain their purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
Which is remarkable, because
you would never
see anything like that, any demands like that in the U.S.
That's right. The idea of purchasing power is unknown to the average worker in the U.S. And as we've said on this show many times, you say that people who are working for unions or do have blue-collar jobs, the schlubs in America who are not working on Wall Street, every time that they go and argue for or protest or negotiate for higher wages, they always ask for wages tied to growth in quote-unquote inflation, which is a cooked number that is perpetually understated so that these blue-collar schlubs don't get any money that they deserve.
Yeah,
they should be arguing for, as we've said on this show before, that their wages should be tied to money supply growth.
Well, exactly, and that's what is important here is, like, the strikes aren't so much against, like, they're just their employer. It's they always identify the central banks and the banks for printing too much money or creating too much money and creating inflation. So they talk about the purchasing power, which is obviously something that, not that their employer would be able to give them, but the government.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. They've connected the dots. They understand the relationship between government, labor, and purchasing power. And you see that across Europe, something that is completely lost in the U.S. How much time do we got in this show left?
Honey, we have 4 or 5 minutes. I think we're going to have to ask them to give us a 15-minute show from now on, because the last 8 minutes, for some reason, you always trail off.
No. I think the reason is we don't actually have a clock, do we?
It's right there. Right there in big, giant numbers, digital numbers, counting down right there in front of you.
Really?
You just have to open your eyes. See?
Oh, I never saw that. Oh, okay.
It's huge.
Well, and we do 58 minutes?
We do 58 minutes here,
on this show,
right here on Resonance 104.4 FM in London.
That's right. So next week, we got a new show starting with Russia Today. It's a weekly show. Hopefully, this will go on. We shoot the show. It broadcasts on Thursdays, right?
On Thursdays, yep.
So our On the Edge show broadcasts on Fridays, but we'll have a new weekly show called The Kaiser Report. And it'll be broadcast on Thursdays. And for people who were fans of our Oracle show back in January of this year, this will be similar in that we're going to see little Stacinium on the show.
Max has made me an element.
You're on the periodic table. You know, that's what happens when you have a period.
Uh-huh.
It's stacinium. It's in between lead and plutonium.
Right. So our first guest, should we say who it's going to be?
I'd like to know myself.
Exactly. Well, he's Konstantin Gurdjieff, and he's Irish. He's Russian, living in Ireland for the last 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have him talk about NAMA, which is now, I guess, getting the go-ahead in Ireland.
What's it stand for, NAMA?
Something about asset management, asses for the asses.
That's right. It's the government's taking over all the, buying out all the failed real estate speculators.
Yeah. The developers or something. So we're going to find out from him.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have booked over the next few weeks. We have Matt Taibbi. It's going to be
right,
on
Matt
the
Taibbi,
show.
Yeah. Did you say Taibbi or Taibbi?
I don't know. We're going to have to ask
him. All right. We'll get that all squared away. He wrote the famous Rolling Stone article about Goldman Sachs.
That's right. We have somebody, a Der Spiegel journalist, to talk about Afghanistan.
Now, Danny Schechter is on which show?
And Danny Schechter is on the show, too.
Oh, good. Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He's on the show.
Yeah. He's got a great new book out, which is, I'm reading it right now. It's actually not available yet, or perhaps it is from today, but it's called The Crime of the Century.
Oh, yeah.
It's really good.
Well, I tell people I'd get Alec Baldwin on the show, star of 30 Rock on NBC, but everyone just yawns and says, who cares? Nobody seems to think that's a big deal, so I'm not going to bother. Unless you want to email Alec yourself and say, Alec, please go on Max's show. I'll give you his email address. I'll give you the email address of his production company, El Dorado Pictures. Email him. Tell him you want to be on the show. Otherwise, you won't be on the show because I don't think anyone cares about Alec Baldwin being on the show. I don't know why.
Okay. Well, yeah, so we have some really interesting guests coming up. Steve Keen as well. He'll be on the show.
Yeah, that's right. And we're doing this show live in London, right?
We're going to do this show, The Truth About Markets, right here on Resonance 104.4 FM. We're going to do it live on December 16th, 17th, 18th, Saturday, December 18th.
So we'll be in the studio doing it live. Maybe we'll do one of those get-togethers.
I think we're going to have to.
What? I think we should do the get-together after the show instead of before the show, because before the show, everyone's all excited and they're talking, and then we got to break it up to go do the show. And
yeah,
then
plus,
you're doing
plus
the show.
Your voice gets all hoarse.
What's up? Oh, we got to go soon.
Not like, yes, now we have to go. You can't start jibber-jabbering.
They never send us emails on this show. You know, the people in our on the Edge show send us emails all the time. Nobody sent us an email on this show.
Yeah, we get like 50 emails per week or per episode of On the Edge.
Yeah, no one. Anyway, see you next week. Bye, y'all.